Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, March 22nd, 2024. The U.S. House narrowly passes a $1.2 trillion fiscal year 2024 spending bill covering the Departments of Defense, Homeland Security, State, and Health, sending it to the Senate, which has until midnight tonight to pass it and get President Biden to sign it into law, or there could be a partial government shutdown. Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene files a motion to vacate to remove Republican Speaker Mike Johnson. She tweets, "We need a Speaker of the House who will fight to secure America's border at all costs, not one that passes a trillion-dollar Democrat wish list that continues the border invasion, funds the weaponized government, and breaks our own conference rules." The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre is asked about what happened at the U.S.-Mexico border in El Paso, Texas, when hundreds of migrants broke through razor wire and overcame National Guard soldiers. A U.S.-backed UN Security Council resolution calling for a ceasefire in the war between Israel and Hamas and the release of hostages held by Hamas fails after both Russia and China exercise their veto power. Secretary of State Antony Blinken in Israel meets with the Prime Minister and his war cabinet. And also the White House responding to the news that Kate Middleton, Princess of Wales, has been diagnosed with cancer. Story from TheHill.com, the House approved a $1.2 trillion government funding bill Friday, sending the sprawling package to the Senate hours before the deadline, and officially capping off the fiscal 2024 appropriations process in the lower chamber. The legislation, which includes six funding bills, cleared the House in a 286-130 vote, hours before a slew of agencies and programs are set to run out of funding. Senate is expected to quickly take a package, with hopes of getting it over the finish line before midnight, so lawmakers can avoid a lapse in funding and begin their two-week Easter recess. President Biden has said he will sign the bill. That was from The Hill. Here's the House floor debate, beginning with the Appropriations Committee chair and ranking Democrat, both of whom supported the bill. Kay Granger, Republican from Texas, is the chair.
Madam Speaker, I rise today in support of the appropriations package. And I want to start by thanking all the members and staff who were involved in this process. We looked hard at our needs and developed a package to carry us through the process. 2 weeks ago, I talked about the changes House Republicans made regarding how we fund the government. We made targeted cuts to wasteful programs and developed a package that is proof of that. We looked at each need, and it was clear that the world is becoming a more dangerous place. We made changes and decided on efforts that include countering China, developing next-generation weapons, and investing in the quality of life of our service members. I'm proud to say that this bill strengthens our national security and funds critical defense efforts. This package also includes other key priorities. It continues our strong support of Israel, combats the flow of illegal drugs, and fully funds medical research for cancer and chronic diseases. Against all odds, House Republicans refocused spending the America's most crucial need of home and abroad. I urge my colleagues to support this bill, and I reserve the balance of my time.
Congresswoman Kay Granger, Republican from Texas, the Appropriations Committee chair on the House floor. She has already announced that she's not going to run for re-election this year. She announced today that she'll be stepping down as Appropriations Committee chair for the remainder of her term. Rosa DeLauro from Connecticut is the Appropriations Committee ranking Democrat. She, too, supported this funding package.
I strongly support the bipartisan bill, which funds the majority of the United States government. This bill sides with the hardworking majority of Americans. It helps to lower the cost of living. It protects women's rights and access to reproductive health care. It reinforces America's global leadership, and it helps our communities be safe and secure. I am pleased that Democrats and Republicans again united to make government work for the people of this country. Like the funding bill we passed earlier this month, this legislation does not have everything either side may have wanted. But I am satisfied that many of the extreme cuts and the policies proposed by House Republicans were rejected. I'm enormously proud that we are providing an increase of $1 billion for childcare, for Head Start, expanding access to quality and affordable childcare for hardworking families. We increased Title I education funding, protecting 224,000 teachers' jobs House Republicans tried to eliminate. I'm also pleased that we successfully defeated every one of the Republicans' extreme policy riders in the labor HHS bill. In this package, we prioritize the men and women in our armed services and their families by securing pay and allowance increases of over 5%, the highest increase in decades. We invest in global health and support 12,000 special immigrant visas for Afghans that assisted the United States and critically we strengthened our border security. I urge swift passage of this passage, and I look forward to moving on how we can best serve the American people in the fiscal year 2025. I reserve the balance of my time.
Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut, the ranking member on the Appropriations Committee on the House floor today. Congressman Chip Roy, Republican of Texas, member of the Freedom Caucus, opposed this bill.
Well, here we are again. The swamp is back in full force. We have a 1,000-page bill of $1.2 trillion filled with all manners of spending priorities that are at odds with the American people. That's what we have in front of us. This bill is over 1,000 pages long. It contains hundreds of pages of report language, 1,400 earmarks, and we've had about 24 hours to review it. That is not the way to do business. And the American people and American families are the ones left holding the bag. This is business as usual in the swamp. And here's the deal to my Republican colleagues. You will own every single bit of this. If you vote for this bill, you own it. DHS funding contingent on signing HR 2 into law. That's what we did last year to make sure our border would be secure. That is punted. So you own it. Defunding Alejandro Mayorkas. We did that in our bill. This punts that. It's no longer there. You own it. Prohibiting mass parole and release of illegal aliens via the CBP One app. We did that in our bill last year. This bill gets rid of it. You own it. You own the continued mass parole of illegal aliens into our country. You own that. That's the truth. And it was mass parole that led to a Venezuelan gang member coming into the United States and killing Lake and Riley. And you can't go campaign, my Republican colleagues cannot go campaign against mass parole and use the name of Lake and Riley because you pass a bill in her name when you fund the very policies that lead to her death. I hear all this, that we're going to increase beds, ICE beds. We're going to increase the numbers for Border Patrol. The increased numbers for Border Patrol will process more illegal aliens. The increased number of beds for ICE will not be used because there's memos in place by Alejandro Mayorkas, whom we impeached and whom this bill will fund. Those ICE beds will not be filled. They won't be used, and we know it. We set out to prohibit DHS from fast-tracking asylum. This bill doesn't do that. We set out to make sure this border would be secure and you could end what happened yesterday in Texas, where 100 illegal aliens bum-rushed our border, rolled over the Texas National Guard, fled into this country, and went to Border Patrol to get released into the United States. That is what this bill continues to fund. And any of my Republican colleagues who want to spend this year campaigning against open borders, it's a laugh, because today, if you vote for this abomination of a bill, you will be voting to fund it. You will be voting to fund the very policies that you will campaign against.
Congressman Chip Roy, Republican from Texas, on the House floor. The House went on to pass this $1.2 trillion spending package for fiscal year 2024. Six of the 12 annual spending bills included defense, financial services, homeland security, labor, health and human services, education, legislative branch, and State Department and Foreign Operations. The vote was 286 to 134, more than the two-thirds vote needed, just more, just barely more than the two-thirds under the procedure that they used. More Democrats than Republicans voted in favor of the bill, 185 Democrats to 101 Republicans. On the no side, 112 Republicans and 22 Democrats. You heard from Congressman Roy some of the reasons why Republicans were voting no. On the Democratic side, one of the issues was a one-year ban in the bill on funding the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees, or UNRWA. Congressman Ro Khanna, Democrat from California, posting on X, "I will vote no on this bill that bans aid to children in Gaza who are dying of hunger. Forget the politics and procedural jargon. This is a test of first principles. The America I believe in must never be indifferent to the man-made starvation of children." From Fox News, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican of Georgia, told reporters on Friday that she filed a motion to vacate House Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican of Louisiana, accusing him of having betrayed the confidence of the House GOP conference by ushering through a bipartisan $1.2 trillion federal funding bill to avoid a partial government shutdown. Johnson won the gavel in late October after his predecessor was ousted by a motion to vacate resolution earlier that month. That was from Fox News. Congresswoman Greene spoke to reporters on the steps of the U.S. Capitol building.
"This bill was basically a dream and a wish list for Democrats and for the White House. It was completely led by Chuck Schumer, not our Republican Speaker of the House, not our conference, and we weren't even allowed to put amendments to the floor to have a chance to make changes to the bill. I filed the motion to vacate today, but it's more of a warning and a pink slip. I respect our conference. I paid all my dues to my conference. I'm a member in good standing, and I do not wish to inflict pain on our conference and to throw the house in chaos. But this is basically a warning, and it's time for us to go through the process, take our time, and find a new Speaker of the House that will stand with Republicans and our Republican majority instead of standing with the Democrats."
That is a warning. If it's a warning, does that mean that you're not going to go through and force this vote?
No, I will.
There's nothing that can convince you to back off.
There's not a time limit on this. It doesn't have to be forced and throw the house into chaos. I don't want to put any of our members in a difficult place like we were for 3.5 weeks. We're going to continue our committee work. We're going to continue our investigations. There's a lot of good investigations going that have to be able to proceed, and the American people deserve that. But I'm not saying that it won't happen in 2 weeks or it won't happen in a month or who knows when, but I am saying the clock has started. It's time for our conference to choose a new speaker.
Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, speaking to reporters on the steps of the U.S. Capitol building. She filed that motion to vacate, but as she noted, it would only force a vote if she files it as a privileged resolution, meaning House speakers would need to act within 2 legislative days, and the House is starting a 2-week recess today. Speaker Johnson's office telling Fox News Digital in a statement, "Speaker Johnson always listens to the concerns of members, but is focused on governing. He will continue to push conservative legislation that secures our border, strengthens our national defense, and demonstrates how we'll grow our majority." Also, at least one Democrat, Tom Suozzi, just elected in a special election, is from New York, telling CNN that he would not vote to remove House Speaker Mike Johnson should it come to that. The fiscal year 2024 spending bill, now that it's passed the House, heads over to the Senate. This morning, the Majority Leader Chuck Schumer anticipating House passage and calling on senators to be ready to move quickly on the bill.
"At about 12:01 a.m. tonight, about 70% of the federal government will run out of funding if Congress does not act. Democrats and Republicans have about 13 hours to work together to make sure the government stays open. That's not going to be easy. We will have to work together and avoid unnecessary delays. This morning, the House will move first on the funding package, and as soon as they send us a bill, the Senate will spring into action. To my colleagues on both sides, let's finish the job today. Let's avoid even a weekend shutdown. Let's finish the job of funding the government for the remainder of the fiscal year. There is no reason to delay. There is no reason to drag out this process. If senators cooperate on a time agreement, if we prioritize working together, just as we did 2 weeks ago, I'm optimistic we can succeed. But if individual senators resort to partisanship and stonewalling and dithering, those individuals will almost guarantee that we shut down, and the process could drag into Saturday, Sunday, and possibly beyond. Now, this appropriations process hasn't been easy, but I'm glad that after months of hard work, we've arrived at a funding package that both sides can be pleased with. The funding package will go a long way to supporting American families, strengthening our economy, safeguarding our national security.
The Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, on the Senate floor as they met about 11 a.m. Eastern. And as we are now on the air, just after 5 p.m. Eastern, no agreement yet on moving forward towards a final vote on that $1.2 trillion government funding bill. Mid-afternoon, one of the opponents, Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, spoke on the floor.
The ever-increasing heights of our debt mean a weak economy, high inflation, and confiscatory tax rates. In other words, today's spending threatens tomorrow's prosperity. We're approaching a predictable economic crisis in the U.S. In my time in the Senate, I have proposed spending freezes, balanced budgets, spending cuts designed to get our nation back on path. Today, though, instead of a balanced budget, I merely ask this, that this bill be sent back to the Appropriations Committee and that they report to the full Senate about how to responsibly cut 5% from this bloated monstrosity. We wouldn't eliminate anything, but everything you're going to spend money on, grandma, motherhood, apple pie, is going to get 5% less. That's what it would take to start balancing our budget. Wouldn't do it just on this bill, because we'd actually have to do that to everything in all the spending, but doing it here today would show that somebody's serious about the spending. My instructions even leave the Appropriations Committee open to determine where to reduce the spending. This isn't asking that much. It's a lopsided compromise in which the select handful of members who wrote this bill get 95% of everything they want. That's what it would mean if we were to pass this cut. Realize when we vote on this cut, though, that not one Democrat will vote to cut one penny. Seriously, if we offered an amendment to cut one penny, every Democrat would vote no on it. They're resisting voting at all now because they're worried that people at home will discover what they're voting for. But it's more than just the Democrats. No Democrat cares about the deficit. Many Republicans profess to care, but half of them will vote with the Democrats as well. So this is really a bipartisan problem. So don't let anybody tell you this is just all about Joe Biden. It's about the previous administration as well. They borrowed $7 trillion. They shut the economy down. The COVID lockdowns led to extravagant borrowing, more than we've ever seen, and we're continuing it now. But this is a bipartisan problem. It means that rather than spending $1.2 trillion in this package, my proposal would spend $1.14 trillion. Now, some would look at that and say, well, gosh, that's not even very dramatic at all. How did you become so moderate? And, you know, that is true. I am quite the moderate. But it would cut $60 billion. $60 billion. But they will unanimously on the Democrat side vote against this because they're against cutting one penny. And our side, half of our people on our side, will vote against any cuts also. This is a modest cut and only the beginning of what you would have to do to bring fiscal sanity. I'm willing to accept a reasonable compromise, even one that does not balance the budget significantly or even cut the necessary spending. I'm willing to vote for something to cut some spending.
Senator Rand Paul, Republican from Kentucky, on the Senate floor. Washington Post has an article that says this legislation's passage in the Senate is not in doubt. It has the support of President Biden, the Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. But a single senator can throw up procedural roadblocks that push the government past the deadline and force a vote days later. The consequences of a brief shutdown would be mostly muted. Many federal workers at unfunded agencies would be off for the weekend anyway. But if a closure goes longer, more than half of IRS employees would face furloughs at the height of tax filing season. Border Patrol officers and about 1.3 million active duty military service members would remain on the job without pay. So would Transportation Security Administration screeners, many of whom called in sick as a protest after a previous shutdown dragged on for weeks, sparking nationwide travel delays. That from the Washington Post. And again, to summarize, the $1.2 trillion government funding bill, covering about 70% of the discretionary part of the budget, has passed the House, is pending in the Senate, and tonight, midnight, is the deadline for that partial government shutdown. From the Daily Caller, the White House blamed former President Donald Trump for new dramatic video of illegal immigrants storming across the border, tearing down a barrier, and overwhelming the Texas National Guard Thursday in a statement shared with the Daily Caller. Illegal immigrants were caught at the U.S.-Mexico border Thursday, pulling a barrier open while four National Guardsmen tried to keep the situation under control. The White House blamed Donald Trump for the chaos, pointing to his opposition toward a bipartisan Senate bill proposed last month that would have allocated funds to Ukraine, Israel, and the southern border crisis. That was from the Daily Caller. Here's more on this from today's White House briefing with Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre.
Thank you. So on this border video, what does President Biden think should happen to adult men who are assaulting and overpowering U.S. National Guardsmen?
Well, let me just first say we're grateful, and I said this moments ago, to Border Patrol agents to quickly work and get the situation under control and apprehend the migrants. So I want to be really clear that everyone who was apprehended by Border Patrol, they were able to do their job, even though it's made it more, even though Republican governor, in particular Governor Abbott, has made it difficult for them. They need more resources. We need more personnel. I mean, we have to have the backs of our law enforcement on the ground who are dealing with this every day. But Republicans are getting in the way. Republicans in Congress do not want to help. And you have a governor, Governor Abbott, who's politicizing it. That is what's happening. Border Patrol agents did their job, even though, you know, the governor is getting in the way of them doing their jobs.
But I get that you guys, you talk so much about having a more humane immigration system. This video does not show helpless women and children begging for a safe place to come in. It shows adult men landing haymakers on U.S. troops in uniform. If that was happening anywhere else in the world, wouldn't President Biden send reinforcements?
So two things. Everyone was apprehended by the Border Patrol agents. That is important to note. They were apprehended.
Were they deported?
They were apprehended. I can't speak to individual cases. That's not something I can do from here. But they were all apprehended. That's number one. And the reason why you're talking about the Texas National Guard, they were there because of the governor of Texas. The governor of Texas put the Texas National Guard there. We didn't put them there. He put them there. What we need is actually real solutions. We need to see resources. The Border Patrol agents deserve resources. They deserve to be able to do their jobs. And we're not getting that from Republicans. They're rejecting a bipartisan agreement that came out of the Senate.
The White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, at her news conference at the White House. The fiscal year 2024 spending bill that passed the House today, the $1.2 trillion pending in the Senate, includes $25.3 billion for FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, most of that for disaster relief. The head of FEMA, Deanne Criswell, spoke today about new policies for getting people federal aid during and after a natural disaster to make it easier, quicker, less frustrating, and less bureaucratic. She was at the Atlantic Council in Washington.
These are the most transformational changes that we've made to this program in 20 years. And it's allowed us to truly take all of the information we hear from people and the barriers that they have in trying to access assistance from our state and local emergency managers and the struggles that they have in trying to help people get the assistance that they need and really breaking down those barriers and removing them so we can help people on their road to recovery faster. A couple of examples. And I think the biggest one that I get probably the most applause when I talk to people about is in the past, yesterday, you would, if your home was damaged for a certain part of FEMA's programs, I would actually go make you apply for an SBA loan, have you get denied, and then come back, and then you would be eligible for FEMA assistance.
Sounds like healthcare.
Perhaps.
Yeah.
But I think the biggest part of that is we're asking the people who we know are the most vulnerable, right? The most resource deficient, to go through this extra step just to be told, yes, you are resource deficient, and then you can get federal help. It was, to me, a bit demoralizing. And so now we've taken that away. Now that is, we've decoupled those two programs. And so now any of FEMA's programs, you don't have to go through that process first. You can apply for FEMA grants, but you can also apply for an SBA loan at the same time, which some people will use, right? It's a really great resource because our programs help jumpstart the recovery. And there are things like insurance or SBA loans that really help provide additional resources. And so that's one big example of one of the barriers that we continued to hear that people weren't applying. There's a large number of people that we would send to that route that we knew needed help, but then would never come back because it was just confusing.
Administrator of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, Deanne Criswell, at the Atlantic Council today in Washington, D.C. She was talking about changes to the federal disaster relief aid programs that kick in today. On Wall Street, the Dow down 305, NASDAQ up 26, S&P down 7. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi, it's Kayla from C-SPAN. Imagine 45 years ago when there was just a handful of television networks. C-SPAN first went on the air bringing an unfiltered view of government directly to America's living rooms. No spin, no commentary, just pure democracy in action.
And it's Greta from C-SPAN. It was a bold experiment. We finally had a front row seat to Congress, the White House, and the campaign trail, all without government funding.
As we celebrate 45 years and a legacy of unfiltered access, we ask for your support of a donation in honor of our four decades of service. Your gift, no matter how big or small, will help maintain this vital resource for access to the democratic process.
You can help ensure another 45 years of witnessing history unfold and empowering citizens to be informed and engaged in the political process. Visit cspan.org/donate today and join our 45th anniversary campaign.
Thank you for supporting C-SPAN, your unfiltered view of government. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make your gift of support. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app. Associated Press reporting that Russia and China on Friday vetoed a U.S.-sponsored UN resolution calling for an immediate and sustained ceasefire in the Israeli-Hamas war in Gaza to protect civilians and enable humanitarian aid to be delivered to more than 2 million hungry Palestinians. The vote in the 15-member Security Council was 11 members in favor, 3 against, and 1 abstention. Before the vote, Russia's UN ambassador, Vasily Nebenzia, said that Moscow supports an immediate ceasefire, but he questioned the language in the resolution and accused U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield of misleading the international community for politicized reasons. The resolution declared that a ceasefire is imperative. The draft that was put to a vote made no direct link to the release of hostages taken during Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, which was in the previous draft, but it unequivocally supported diplomatic efforts to secure such a ceasefire in connection with the release of all remaining hostages. That was the reporting from Associated Press. Here are some of the statements. First, from U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, on the vetoes.
Colleagues, today the United States put forward a resolution in good faith after consulting with all council members and after multiple rounds of edits. The vast majority of this council voted in favor of this resolution. But unfortunately, Russia and China decided to exercise its veto. And now, Russia and China will give you all sorts of explanations for its obstruction. But whether or not it will admit it, there are two deeply, deeply cynical reasons behind its votes. First, Russia and China still could not bring itself to condemn Hamas's terrorist attacks on October 7th. Can we just pause on that for a moment? Russia and China refuses to condemn Hamas for burning people alive, for gunning down innocent civilians at a concert, for raping women and girls, for taking hundreds of people hostage. This was the deadliest single attack on Jews since the Holocaust. And a permanent member of this council can't even condemn it. I'm sorry, it's really outrageous, and it's below the dignity of this body. The second reason behind this veto is not just cynical, it's also petty. Russia and China simply did not want to vote for a resolution that was penned by the United States because it would rather see us fail than to see this council succeed, even after inclusive consultations over weeks and weeks, even after negotiations and edits produced a draft that received overwhelming council support. And as you saw today, nearly every council member voted to put the full weight of this body behind the diplomatic efforts to secure an immediate and sustained ceasefire as part of a deal that leads to the release of all hostages that will allow much more humanitarian aid to get into Gaza. But once again, Russia put politics over progress. Russia, who has carried out an unprovoked war on its neighbor, has the audacity and the hypocrisy to throw stones when it lives in a glass house itself. So let's be honest, for all the fiery rhetoric, we all know that Russia and China are not doing anything diplomatically to advance a lasting peace or to meaningfully contribute to the humanitarian response effort. Colleagues, there is obviously another resolution that some of you would like to be considered, but in its current form, that text fails to support sensitive diplomacy in the region. Worse, it could actually give Hamas an excuse to walk away from the deal on the table.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Linda Thomas-Greenfield at today's Security Council meeting at the UN in New York City. The Russian ambassador, Vasily Nebetsia, spoke against the resolution before the veto. Here is some of his remarks. You'll be hearing the interpreter.
6 months have elapsed. Gaza has virtually been wiped from the earth. And now the U.S. representative, without blinking, has been asserting that Washington has finally begun to recognize the need for a ceasefire. This sluggish thought process in Washington has come at the cost of the lives of 32,000 peaceful Palestinians, two-thirds of whom are women and children. And even now we have observed a typical hypocritical spectacle when, wrapped up in a ceasefire, the United States have been trying to sell a product to the membership of the Security Council and to the entire international community. They've been trying to sell something completely different, namely a diluted formulation about a definition and determination of the imperative for a ceasefire. This kind of philosophical passages about moral imperatives are seen in limited quantities in the work of Immanuel Kant. However, to save the lives of peaceful Palestinian civilians, this is not enough. And this is in no way what is stipulated in the mandate of the UN Security Council, the council which is vested with a unique mechanism to demand a ceasefire and, where necessary, to compel compliance therewith. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, during an official interview in Jeddah on the 20th of March with the correspondent Al-Hadakh, stated, and I quote, "Well, in fact, we actually have a resolution that we put forward right now that's before the UN Security Council that does call for an immediate ceasefire tied to the release of hostages, and we hope very much that countries will support that," end quote. However, in the text of the U.S. draft, which has been put to the vote today, there is no such call. So what turns out is that either the U.S. representative at the United Nations or the U.S. Secretary of State have been deliberately misleading the international community.
Through the interpreter, the Russian ambassador to the United Nations, Vasily Nebetsia, at today's Security Council meeting. The vote on the U.S.-backed resolution was 11 in favor, 3 against, Russia, China, and Algeria, and 1 abstention, Guyana. The votes of Russia and China, since they're permanent Security Council members, count as vetoes. Story from Reuters. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said on Friday that Israel remained determined to send troops into the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians are sheltering, and would do so without U.S. backing if necessary. Netanyahu said in a statement he had told visiting U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken that there was no way to defeat the Islamist movement Hamas without going into Rafah. He said, "And I told him that I hope we will do it with the support of the U.S., but if we have to, we will do it alone." That from Reuters. Secretary Blinken spoke to reporters at the airport before he left Israel.
Can you tell us in practical terms what the U.S. was trying to achieve with the resolution that was put forward at the United Nations today? And then on your conversations today, you described in broad strokes some themes that are familiar. I wonder whether you delivered or heard any messages today that are new and different from your past conversations here.
So on the resolution, which got very strong support, but then was cynically vetoed by Russia and China, I think we were trying to show the international community's sense of urgency about getting a ceasefire tied to the release of hostages, something that everyone, including the countries that vetoed the resolution, should have been able to get behind. The resolution, of course, also condemned Hamas. It's unimaginable why countries wouldn't be able to do that. But I think the fact that we got such a strong vote despite the veto by two of the permanent members of the Security Council, again, is evidence and demonstration of the commitment, the conviction of countries around the world, notably on the Security Council, to see about getting the ceasefire and getting the release of hostages now. That's what the resolution said. That's what it called for. And I think it showed that a strong commitment to that from many, many countries. With regard to the conversations we had, look, this is an ongoing process. As I said, we really were focused on three things: the hostage negotiations, humanitarian assistance, and Rafah. And it was important that, again, we focus on all three things. I'm not going to get into the details of what we discussed, but I think from my perspective at least, these were important, candid conversations to have at a critical time on all three of those issues.
Is it real that it will be isolated if it doesn't change its path?
Again, what I shared, and I think what they've heard from President Biden as well directly, is we have the same goals: the defeat of Hamas, Israel's long-term security. But a major ground operation in Rafah is not, in our judgment, the way to achieve it. And you know, we've been very clear about that. But most important, we have a senior team coming to Washington next week. We'll all be taking part in those discussions. We'll be able to lay out for them in detail. I started to do that today, but it's important that the teams, with all the expertise, lay out in detail how those goals can best be accomplished with an integrated humanitarian, military, and political plan. We'll put all that on the table. Of course, we'll hear from them too, and we'll take it to next week.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken speaking to reporters at the airport in Tel Aviv, Israel, after meetings with the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, and his war cabinet. This is the sixth trip to the Middle East that Secretary Blinken has taken since the start of the war between Israel and Hamas last October. Associated Press from Moscow reporting several assailants burst into a large concert hall in Moscow on Friday and sprayed the crowd with gunfire, killing at least 40 people, injuring more than 100 others, and setting fire to the venue in a brazen attack just days after President Vladimir Putin cemented his grip on power in a highly orchestrated electoral landslide. AP goes on, it wasn't immediately clear what happened to the attackers, and there were no immediate claims of responsibility for the raid, which the Moscow mayor described as a huge tragedy and which state authorities were investigating as terrorism. This was happening as John Kirby, the White House National Security Communications Advisor, was beginning a briefing at the White House in Washington.
Obviously, we've all seen the reports and the video coming out of Moscow, this violent shooting at looks like a shopping mall. Can't speak much to the details of it. I mean, this was all just breaking before I came on out here, so we're trying to get more information, but really would refer to Russian authorities to speak to it. The images are just horrible. Just hard to watch, and our thoughts obviously are going to be with the victims of this terrible shooting attack. And I think, you know, you look at that video if you have, and you got to recognize that there's some moms and dads and brothers and sisters and sons and daughters that haven't gotten the news yet. And this is going to be a tough day. So our thoughts are with them. You might have also seen, hopefully you saw our State Department, our embassy there, put out a notice to all Americans in Moscow to avoid any large gathering, concerts, obviously shopping malls, anything like that, just for their own safety. They should stay put where they are and stay plugged into the State Department for any additional updates and information. I'm afraid that's really all I have on that.
John Kirby, White House National Security Communications Advisor, responding to the news out of Moscow. Yahoo News from United Kingdom has a story that King Charles has said he's proud of the Princess of Wales after she revealed she has been diagnosed with cancer and is undergoing a course of preventive chemotherapy. In an emotional video message recorded on Wednesday, released on Friday, Kate said it had come as a huge shock and that she and William were doing everything to manage this privately for the sake of our young family. The announcement follows a prolonged period of absence from public life as she recovered from abdominal surgery in January, which at times sparked unfounded speculation over her health issues. That was from Yahoo News, United Kingdom. Here's part of the video that Kate Middleton put out.
It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them, and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay. As I've said to them, I am well and getting stronger every day by focusing on the things that will help me heal in my mind, body and spirit. Having William by my side is a great source of comfort and reassurance too, as is the love, support and kindness that has been shown by so many of you. It means so much to us both. We hope that you'll understand that as a family, we now need some time, space, and privacy while I complete my treatment. My work has always brought me a deep sense of joy, and I look forward to being back when I'm able. But for now, I must focus on making a full recovery. At this time, I'm also thinking of all those whose lives have been affected by cancer. For everyone facing this disease, in whatever form, please do not lose faith or hope. You are not alone.
Video message, part of it from Kate Middleton, Princess of Wales. The video was being released right as the White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, started her news conference in Washington.
We just heard, obviously all of us just heard the terrible news. Our thoughts are with the Duchess of Cambridge and her family members and friends during this incredibly difficult time. And certainly we wish her a full recovery. And I think it's important that we respect their privacy, especially at this time. So I'm not going to go further than that. I will do one more thing before that, though. I know folks are going to ask if the president has spoken to her or the family. I can just say right now that we don't have anything to share at this time. But obviously, we wish the Duchess of Cambridge a full recovery, and we are incredibly sad to hear of the news.
The White House Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre. This is Washington Today. Story from the New York Times, defying boundaries of taste and time, Martin Greenfield made suits for President Dwight D. Eisenhower, the gangster Meyer Lansky, Leonardo DiCaprio, and LeBron James, men skilled in the arts of power projection, along with fashion writers and designers, considered him the nation's greatest men's tailor. For years, none of them knew the origins of his expertise, a beating at Auschwitz. As a teenager, Mr. Greenfield was Maximilian Grunfeld, a skinny Jewish prisoner whose job was to wash the clothes of Nazi guards at the concentration camp. In the laundry room one day, he accidentally ripped the collar of a guard's shirt. The man whipped Max in response, then hurled the garment back at the boy. After a fellow prisoner taught Max how to sew, he mended the collar, but then decided to keep the shirt, sliding it under the striped shirt of his prison uniform. That was from the New York Times. Martin Greenfield, who was announced on Wednesday, has died in New York. He emigrated to the United States after the war. He was 95 years old. In 2015, he was on C-SPAN 2's Book TV talking about his memoir, Measure of a Man, From Auschwitz Survivor to President's Tailor.
And I wrote the book the way my brother now, told you why I wrote it to America, to thank America, because I was shocked that there were so many survivors who survived and they didn't do it, but I had to do it. Because 5 million of us are alive today, not they're all alive, some of them died, but they were saved by the Americans. I knew the past, that Roosevelt sent back 300 Jews to die, who came here in a boat, but that was history to me, that I read about. But it doesn't matter what Roosevelt did. That's all mattered to me, what the soldiers did in America and what they have to do all the day, because the only thing that work is strength. Strength. America is the strongest country in the world. You don't go around apologizing. You go around fighting for the right of America, because everybody wants to come here. Everybody. We all want to come here because there is no place like it. You can't change it. And don't try. Nobody should try to change it. And it only takes the young people. In my business, the most important people are the young people, because you are the guys that dress. The older people like us, we need a wedding, we need a funeral without suit. You need us. You are our future. Because you dress to become, and you are the future. We are older, and you are our future. That's how I look at you, and that's what I expect of you.
Martin Greenfield talking about his book Measure of a Man, from Auschwitz Survivor to President's Tailor, on C-SPAN 2's Book TV in 2015. He has died this week at the age of 95. Mike Bloomberg, former New York City mayor and presidential candidate, posting, "Martin Greenfield personified the very best of New York City, and his life is one of the most inspiring stories of our time. It was a great honor to be a customer." Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, word for word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox every day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.